The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for the opportunity to come here and learn about how to use the giftings you've given us. And I thank you for business. I thank you that your heart is to see it transformed along with the rest of the world to glorify you and to shine your light. I thank you for Steve, that you would put on his heart to come here and share the wisdom that you have taught him. I pray that you would bless this time and bless us as we listen to the talk, that our hearts might be more focused on you. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.
Well, greetings, everybody, and thank you for coming to this workshop. The first time I taught that course about 7 years ago, it was called Tent Making Entrepreneurship. The term business as mission hadn't even been used yet, and so I wanted to do this course, and we called it Tent Making Entrepreneurship, and five students signed up. Now, we're the biggest major on campus, and so five students is not many relative to the size of our students. And three of those students had no clue what on earth this course was about. And the other two only had a vague idea. And so it's been a learning experience how to teach this to young people, and I can tell you it was pretty lonely in those early years, 8-10 years ago. There were few people connecting business and missions at all and using those in the same sentence at all. And so it's a real thrill to be here and to see an entire track devoted to business as mission. I was at the last Urbana, and there were about half a dozen workshops on business. In all the hundreds and hundreds of workshops, there were about six that were related to business and the role of business people in missions. And so this is, we've come a long way even just in 3 years. So it's just a thrill to see all of you here. And I'm just thankful for your willingness to sit here for an hour and listen to what I have to say. I was asked to share some lessons, and I have, you know, I speak on a fairly regular basis and have a fair number of presentations I can just pull out of my back pocket and use, and what they asked me to talk about today was not one of those, I had to work on this one a bit more, and I'm actually very pleased to be here to talk about this. And I wanted to start by defining business as mission. By now, you've been exposed to a lot of things, and you've seen, you're starting to get a vision for different components of business and different countries. And in a way, the movement is in this situation right now, and you see. So we're all in complete agreement, right? One's thinking about an apple, one's thinking about an orange and a banana, and 2 years ago, the Lausanne Conference, the Lausanne Committee on World Evangelization, met in Thailand, and it too, for the first time in its history, had an entire track on business. 60 people invited from around the world to talk about the role of business in missions, and this is sort of how I felt after that conference, that when we got to the real hard questions, we tended to avoid those, and so we all walked away with different impressions of what business as mission is. And what might be the case here is some of you are thinking tent making, some marketplace ministry, BAM. Now, these are terms, they're all being floated around here, and some of you may be wondering, you know, what's going on here? Are these different, or are they all the same, and so on? And so I wanted to just spend a minute here and unpack this a little bit. And I've actually published a paper on this. It's come out in a recent book called, I believe it's The Role of Business in Missions, subtitle, oh, I forgot the subtitle, sorry. It's From Something to Empowerment, From Poverty to Empowerment, or something like that. But Tom Steffen is the co-editor, but there's a chapter in the book that kind of lays out, defines this movement, and asks, is business as mission a movement in itself, or is it part of a bigger movement? And I believe it's part of a bigger movement. And so let me unpack that first. This movement involves lay people embracing, or you might say re-embracing, the Great Commission. For at least 100 or more years, the church has drifted into this place where those of us lay people, meaning not the clergy, non-pastors, many of us have believed that our role in the body of Christ and in this missions enterprise is to pay, pray, and stay out of the way. So the missionary organizations are interested in our prayer. They're definitely interested in our financial support. But beyond that, they'll take it from here. And so there's been this separation and so on. This movement, there are some common tenets in all these different branches of the movement. One is that business is a calling. Okay? And I'll come back to that in a little while. Another one is the belief that work itself is good. It's not a product of the fall. Adam and Eve worked prior to sin entering into this world, and God worked, and so it can't be inherently bad. There's intrinsic value in work, and work itself can be an act of worship and a form of ministry. I say can be because, you know, you could be working on bad things too and so on, but this is another common theme in all these different branches or streams of this movement. And then finally, they all tend to emphasize mobilization of lay people. In other words, all of you folks in the audience, now, when you leave here, go serve God in your workplace and start just reflecting Christ more eagerly and without embarrassment in the workplace, and also trying to mobilize pastors to recognize that that this is in fact full-time ministry that you're doing in the workplace. Business as mission, I maintain, and my co-author, is part of this broader movement. And so let's take a look at the different components of this. Many of you may be familiar with tent making. Marketplace ministries, a different component. I'll come back to that in a minute. Business as mission. And then there's this other piece, micro-enterprise development, small and medium-sized enterprise development, where there's still a fair amount of disagreement. Where does this fit? Is this part of the movement or not? And if not, why not? Those who say no, that it's not, would say that this is a donor-funded strategy. Okay, we've had donor-funded missions for at least 200 years, and so there is nothing particularly new here about helping poor people develop their own business. It's good work, and no one's criticizing it, but let's not call it business as mission. These are all self-supporting, self-funded mission activities and ministry activities. Now, how do we distinguish between these components? One way would be to look at vocation, and these two are business-specific. Tent making is broader in nature. Its emphasis is on no matter what your professional skills, you may be a teacher, a nurse, an engineer, or a business person. Everyone is welcome here, and so it's a broader focus in that sense. These are narrower in focus, and we argue in the paper that to some degree, specialization is good. I mean, tent-making organizations have their own events, seminars and conferences, and then there's separate events and conferences here. And to some degree, specialization is good. In fact, even at Lausanne, there was a separate track or a working group on tent making, a separate track for this. There were four separate tracks. If you include microenterprise development, there were four separate tracks. So even Lassonde recognizes that these are different in a way, and some degree of specialization is good. But on the other hand, there's an awful lot of redundancy as well, especially in terms of theology and that sort of thing. Another way to think about this would be these are people who are creating jobs. They're starting a business and creating jobs. These are people who are taking jobs for a hospital or a business and these sorts of things. And I'm not fond of this distinction. Job taking sounds, has negative connotations, like you're taking the job of someone else or something. But in any case, these are individuals who find a job in a cross-cultural context, but these are organizations. Not only are the people themselves reflecting Christ and being good tent makers, but the business itself is redemptive in many ways, and the business is having its own lighthouse or source of light in that dark community. Another way to distinguish these would be the vision. Now here, these are more closely similar. The emphasis on these two groups is cross-cultural. There's a bias, and I'm not saying that in a negative way. I have this bias too, where we have more of an interest in reaching the least reached, and that means usually crossing cultures and this sort of thing. However, there is still a huge need to reach our own people group, you know. And that's the emphasis here of Marketplace Ministries, is equipping business people to become better servants, better ambassadors of Christ in the workplace where they are. And one distinction you'll hear if you've ever studied missions, sometimes people distinguish between missions and ministry. Missions would be a cross-cultural activity. Ministry is a same cultural activity. Now, I don't like splitting hairs, and I'm not ready to shed any blood over that. But in any case, that does tend to be the case here. Now, there are organizations that are international in scope. So, for example, the Fellowship of Companies for Christ International, they have a branch in China and probably India and so on. But they're helping the Indian business community reach out. First of all, ministering to the business community itself, the Christians, mentoring them and so on, but also helping them to reach out to their own kind. So it's more of a near neighbor or monocultural focus there. So there are some distinctions that are useful. Although too much specialization can be counterproductive, I believe. What's driving this movement? First of all, I would say the Holy Spirit. This is not the product of one charismatic speaker or preacher or something like that. This is happening simultaneously all over the world. There are business people in Brazil suddenly just really taking their calling in business much more seriously than before. Africa, Asia, certainly in the U.S. It's happening all over, and there's many people starting to document it, but it's clearly it must be the Holy Spirit at work. But there is a change in the business climate. Now, you know, there's a lot of young people in this audience, and so maybe you don't recognize a change because you grew up in it, but it's only been 10 or 15 or 20 years. I mean, the stark differences in the business climate, one example, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the opening up of China and these sorts of things. But I mean, it's a flat world, as Thomas Friedman says, and I actually teach a course on global economics and unpack this in more detail. But businesses no longer have the luxury of thinking only locally. Well, if you're hairstylist, you don't have to worry about global competition. But many businesses now, it's a fact of life. Your competition and your markets are now global. Your potential sources are global. And the world is just flat. And you, as a worker now, you're competing not with students from your own geographical region. You're competing with students from India and China and so on. And that's the case he makes here. I highly recommend that book if you haven't already read it. Also, there's a changing missions climate. So businesses are being literally forced to go global and to think globally now. On the other hand, missions, they're having almost the opposite problem here in some ways. Many countries now are just resisting, not allowing people in for the sole purpose of proselytizing and so on. They don't see the value in that. They're perfectly willing to have Christians come to their country. Most countries are very open to Christians. But if all you're going to do is proselytize, then no, they don't want that. They want more than that. And, of course, it's becoming a much more dangerous world in some ways. And so even formerly friendly countries, the European Union, South Africa, these sorts of things, are just starting to resist Christian missionaries. The donor model that our missionaries depend on has really reached its capacity. I mean, for those of you that have been trying to raise money, either for your own organization or for your own support and so on, you know this better than I do, that it's harder and harder, it seems, to raise money. There are so many good causes, and it's just hard to raise money through the donor model. And in foreign countries, the church, there, you have a missionary who has planted a church in Brazil, perhaps, or some other country, and unemployment might be 60%, and most of your church members might be without a job, and they can't afford a pastor of their own, so they become dependent on Western missionaries and Western money and so on. And so this whole cycle has really, I think, outlived its purpose to a degree. It was a great innovation 200 or 250 years ago when William Carey and others started to employ this agency model and so on. It was a great innovation, well suited for the times, but I believe now a new model is necessary, and God is moving to reinvent the model for us. Traditional missions, increasingly, especially for young people. I teach at a university, so I'm kind of tuned into the culture of this generation. But very idealistic and ready to serve almost anywhere, but not particularly interested in going through the old approach of raising support for about a year and a half, and then having to come back every few years to maintain those relationships and build more support and that sort of thing. They're perfectly willing to go. Please just pay me and I'll go. The shift now is towards more holistic, self-supporting types of strategies, and even orphanages or you name it. There are a lot of traditional ministry type of activities. Everybody's looking for ways to become less dependent on donations and so on. It's just a trend of our times. So where is the most pressing need? Yeah, many of you have seen this before. Clearly it's in Asia and North Africa. And the verse here, Romans 15:20, is where Paul says he aspires to bring the gospel to places where Christ is not already known. He is not interested in toiling in areas where others are already working. Now, he doesn't say that those others have their priorities wrong. He just says, my bent, my passion is to go where no one else is working. This is good work too, but I want to go where Christ isn't known. And there are many of us in the church, I'm one of these too. It's not that I don't care about the U.S., but I just have this natural orientation towards the needier places. And that's true for pretty much everyone in the BAM movement. There's 1.6 billion people who still don't have any meaningful contact with someone who can explain the gospel in a way that's culturally relevant to them, and so on. Also, 1 John 3:17. For those of you who are rich in the world's resources and so forth, and if you see others who are in desperate need and you don't meet that need, or at least attempt to meet that need, how can you say that the love of God is in you? You know, and again, there are many people who third world poverty is not an abstract notion that we think about maybe at Christmas time or Thanksgiving or something. It's something that we are constantly thinking about and trying to help in our various ways alleviate. Often when I talk to groups, because I've written a book called Great Commission Companies that involves companies that have been created for the purpose of the least reached and least evangelized, and so many people think that I'm here, I am going to try to convince all of you to go to Tajikistan or something and start a company. And I know God doesn't work that way. Typically, you won't wake up or attend a seminar and say, by golly, he's right, I should quit and go to Tajikistan. And it's usually a process. And there's many short-term and part-time opportunities, ways to start to get involved. Typically, this process starts by first recognizing that business is a calling, that your work matters to God, that God loves widgets. I mean, it's not just that he loves that you're making widgets to support missions, but he cares about the widgets themselves. And so it starts with a process of recognizing that you're already in full-time ministry, and then slowly over time you start, God in various ways will start to tug on you and get you to start noticing something, maybe Kazakhstan or Chinese people or something. Maybe you have co-workers or people in your church who are Chinese, and you just start getting drawn into that. And over a process, 5 or 10 years, I never recommend that my undergrad business students go directly overseas. I think it's a process after school. Another 5 or 10 years is usually required. At least my research has shown that the effective ones have prepared years in advance, before they even knew they were ever going to end up in China. They were ministering, reaching out to Chinese people locally and so on. But I intend to, for the rest of my talk, I will first talk about Great Commission companies, and then I'll also direct you to some short-term or part-time opportunities and so on. Okay. What is a Great Commission company? We define it as a socially responsible business. Clearly, you're not going, to Thailand to exploit child labor or to exploit their lax environmental laws and these sorts of things. So you're socially responsible. You're unapologetically for profit. Now, a lot of missionaries who are dabbling in business and so on, I see this all the time, where their intention is to give the profit away as soon as it appears. This feeling, that makes it okay. If, as long as you give it away and so on, it's okay. And of course, there's a lot of issues with that. I wouldn't even call it profit, because they're often donor-supported and the capital was donated and so on. So it's free cash flow, but it's not profit from an economics definition. But in any case, they understand the importance of profit. They are a for-profit. It's not a 501c3 charity. Managed by what I call kingdom professionals, my co-author and I avoided the term tent makers for various reasons, but there's just a lot of confusion out there about what is a tent maker, and so we opted for this. These are professionals who have the kingdom in mind in all that they do, whether it's at home or abroad, but they are kingdom-oriented. And we created specifically for this purpose, to advance the gospel in the least reached and least developed countries. So many great Christian companies out there, and many books about great Christian companies. In fact, so we had to unpack this before we could even get a publisher to publish the book, to explain, you know, there's over 2,000 books about Christian business, so why do we need one more? You know, and so we were saying, these are different. They are a bit different from a Christian company, and we unpack that in chapter 2, I believe, in the book. But the purpose of the business, the whole reason they went to the trouble of, and it is a lot of work to start a company, was because they had a vision for some unreached or undeveloped country. And obviously, to glorify God then in all it does. In the book, we came up with a typology, several ways of thinking about the different models and so on. And almost as soon as the ink was dry, I was finding businesses that didn't quite fit well and so on. And there's so, but it's still a useful way, I believe, in thinking through some of these. One of the continuums here is facilitative versus pioneering. Facilitative companies were created for the purpose of helping some other type of ministry. So, for example, Pura Vida Coffee. You know, he made his fortune at Microsoft and so on. He was looking for something more meaningful to do and so on. And his heart was really touched by what his friend in Costa Rica was doing. And he decides to start this company. And he puts in, you know, what, it's 60, 70 hours. You know, I mean, it's a lot of work to build this company. But now his motivation are the children in Costa Rica that are benefiting from this. It's now, he's headquartered in Seattle, and it's definitely a well-known Christian company. He's having an impact locally well. It's not that he's not doing ministry locally, but the purpose of the business was to advance ministry in various ways, and he's getting more and more creative as he goes in terms of how to promote other ministries, you know, alliances and so on with other ministries. He a bit idealistic in the beginning, decided when they created the business that it would be they would donate 100% of their profits to this ministry in Costa Rica. And so they wrote it into the corporate charter and everything else. And well, they would put some of it, plow some of it back into the company for growth, but the rest, 100% of the rest would go be given away. Well, you think about this though for a minute, and those of you who have read the book, you know what happened here. Well, in his startup phase, he wasn't profitable yet, so there was no profits being plowed back into the company, and he needed more capital to grow the company. Imagine trying to raise money. You're not a charity. The person can't write this off from their taxes. So you're saying, you please invest in my company and you won't get any of it back. and he eventually solved this problem. It was a big problem for at least 6 months, maybe a year, that he really had to sort through that and pray through that. And you can find out more in the book in terms of how he solved that. But it has worked for him. It's not a model I think that many people should try. You shouldn't, put it into your charter that you're going to give away all your profits. It makes it very hard to raise money. The reason I share that, I don't typically share it, but this seminar was lessons learned, and so I'm going to be offering a few lessons along the way. here's a good friend. Her name is Crystal Allman. She was with YWAM, a traditional missionary, early in her life in Colombia. And very creative, very artistic, actually way out there. I'm a more conservative, traditional guy. And she was at our home, and she helped us think about interior design. Boy, I tell you what, it's like the things she was coming up with. But we did adapt some of it. We have this one wall that's plum color, purple. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, a purple wall in my house. But it works. But very creative and no business training whatsoever. But she's doing macrame, and she discovers that the people in the area are very good at doing macrame and so on. And she eventually turns this into a business, a big business, in fact. 25 years it was in business before she ultimately had to shut it down. I'll come back to that in a minute. But here's a case where now the arts and crafts, it seems many missionaries want to go that approach. They find someone who grows soy or something. They want to export that to the U.S. Find, you know, that's their platform or something. They want to help local people export their products to the U.S. So maybe it's handicraft products or some commodities or something like that. Usually it doesn't work. It's just too crowded of a market. This kind of a market, most people don't end up ultimately succeeding with these kind of businesses. But she was one of the exceptions. She was at Nordstrom's one time with her two young daughters, and they were wearing a couple of the jackets. They're actually more outlandish than these. I found these on, I needed some photographs. I have video, but I didn't have any photographs. And so I Googled and actually found these on eBay. They're being sold on eBay. But some of her things are way out there, but gorgeous too. And she was at Nordstrom's with her daughters. They were wearing a couple of the jackets, and one of the buyers from Nordstrom's was there and said, "Where did you get these coats?" "Oh, we make them in Colombia." And so that was a God-inspired connection there. And then she's in Macy's and many other some specialty boutiques and this sort of thing. And then she moved into things like home furnishings, curtains and comforters and these sorts of things. And again, very, very creative. I saw her booth at a trade show one time, and it really stood out. Of all these other interior design booths, hers was, wow, it popped, that's for sure. But at the time she was in this community, it was all Catholic. She would say non-Christian, but that can be sensitive there. But she was in this community that didn't have an evangelical church, no evangelical churches. She is, reflecting Christ every day in her work and ministering to people. And by the time the company did close down, there were six evangelical churches in that community. She doesn't take all the credit. In fact, because she was the boss of the factory, she learned, and I found this in my research too, many people have learned the same lesson, that you can't directly, if you directly do the discipling and these sorts of things, it creates confusion and problems in that business relationship. They're your employee, you're their boss, now suddenly you're their discipler too and their mentor, and suppose you have to discipline them or fire them or something like that. Now they're mad at God and these sorts of things. And so she has learned, like many others, that she had to pretty much stay out of the direct person-to-person witnessing. But nevertheless, churches grew and so forth. For many of the people, though, their faith didn't really blossom until after the company folded. And it's a long story, but the narco traffickers, very often in undeveloped countries, many of you probably know, if you're too high profile, then next thing you know, the mafia starts to pester you or other people. In Colombia, it's the narco traffickers and these sorts of things. And and she started to get a lot of harassment from them. Her car was shot several times in several different incidences. Just many harrowing stories. I've interviewed her for many hours. I have it on tape, but I haven't written it down yet. Eventually, she had to pull the plug. She felt God was telling her time to go. But only then, in many people, did she start to see their faith mature. It was after the business failed that she started to see spiritual fruit. And I raise this again because I was asked to talk about some lessons. This whole idea of what do we mean by a successful Great Commission company? God's definition of success may not be the same as ours. One person told me once, I mean, we're asked to obey, not to succeed necessarily. You might want to just chew on that as small groups later on, but just in terms of how do you define success, it may appear to be a failure from the measures you have created to measure success, but in any event, that's her case. Another way of distinguishing Great Commission companies would be how closely do they work with nonprofits and mission agencies of other types. There are those that we would call independent, and I'm getting more and more familiar with these and more excited about these. These are people probably a lot like you, the young people who are getting ready to graduate, who eventually maybe own or manage a business, and you're not affiliated with an agency or anything like that, but the things that are happening in that workspace, that business for Christ, would just give you chills, you know. And just I'm starting to just collect stories and stories of independent, Great Commission companies. Here's one good friend of mine who took advantage of this flat world. He recognized that there's a lot of small businesses here in the U.S. who can't afford to set up a call center or some, you know, hire engineers in India and so forth. Maybe they need one engineer. Well, to fly out there, to interview, to set this person up in an office or with a computer and then supervise this person, it's just too costly. It's too hard for small businesses to do that. And so that's what he does. It's sort of the manpower model, which is why I gave it this pseudonym, where they have a manager in place there, a Christian and so on. They're doing work for these individual small businesses and so forth. And I have to say, when I was there, the building was under construction, and these were, I believe, temporary quarters. They do keep it somewhat dark. They say it helps them. They prefer it somewhat dark, and I suggested maybe they didn't want me to see the child labor or something. He didn't think it was that funny, though, actually. Actually, very modern facility, five floors and so on. I see Joseph here in the back. He's an excellent example someone who graduated from Biola, in fact, then went on to get his MBA, then went back to his home country of India and started a company, with very kingdom intentions from the outset and so forth. He didn't go join an agency and go through the traditional route and so forth. He just felt led by God to start a company. And it's not that he doesn't partner. He clearly has many creative partnerships with agencies and so on. But just someone who went out and started it on their own. And then there are those that I would call alliances. And Pacific Resources. Is Dwight here? Actually, some of you may have heard or met Dwight by now, but he works very closely with agencies. In fact, he insists that the Americans and the expatriates in general have formal relationships with agencies and this sort of thing. And so this is a continuum, really. There's shades of companies in between these, but here's a guy who felt called to China when he was 11 years old. Back in the early 70s, China was just closed to America. There's no Americans going to China at all, and he's feeling God leading him to China. It didn't make sense. He's 11 years old. Also, he gets a business degree. And, you know, if you're called to be a missionary, you know, what's this business? But again, he obeyed and followed what he felt God was asking him to do. But all the while, he's also spending his summers learning Mandarin. He's starting to learn to reach out and minister to Chinese in his local community and so on, having them over for Thanksgiving dinners and organizing events for Chinese. He's learning their culture and so forth. And by the time China finally opens up and allows foreign companies in, he's working for GE, and they tap him to be his China person. And now he's no longer working for GE, but in that process, he's making lots of good government contacts and so on, learning how to negotiate with the government and with others and so on. And now he has his own company, Pacific Resources, and you see a holding company, actually, for many, many companies. And these are only what he has now. There's many others that have been sold over the years and so on. So if you want to start a business, a factory, or any kind of business in China, who do you call? You go into the Yellow Pages? I mean, that's what he does for a living. And you can't find really a better person more suitable for that. But it took, okay, back to lessons. It was years of preparation again, of learning to reach international students here locally, learning the language and so on, leading Bible studies, just getting involved in ministry in many different ways, developing those skills years before he ever knew how, you know, where he would end up. All right, so some lessons learned, other lessons. God is doing something new, clearly. I mean, I could have shown just dozens of other examples, but for the sake of time, I limited it, of business people. And I regret that all the examples I ended up choosing were Americans, because the same thing is happening in Mexico. There are Mexican Christians who own large businesses, who are starting to really have big impacts in their communities and thinking creatively about how can I not only witness more effectively, but how can I use the business to transform this community and so forth. And Mexico, Brazil, India, China, it's happening everywhere. And God, I believe, is reinventing missions. We're in the middle of a paradigm shift, I believe. And you know, so we're in that messy stage. A lot of us are making mistakes. We're, you know, no one has it perfectly right yet, but we're all learning from each other and so on. I say in our generation because this isn't entirely new, as you saw in the video the first night, second day at plenary, where business has been integrated with ministry and missions throughout the history of the church. We just lost our way a bit when we created this agency model. So we get off the hook. We write a check, send it to the agency, and now we're done with our missions contribution. And that's become a cultural issue now for us that we have to fix. Business people are becoming the vanguard of modern missions. I firmly believe that. I teach at a school of business, and I can't tell you how much joy it gives me to know that I am equipping and mobilizing the next generation of missionaries. I honestly believe that many of our students, many of you probably too, are going to be out there just impacting the kingdom in so many creative ways. New approaches to mobilization are required. So the church is struggling to respond to this. Pastors don't quite know what to do with this yet. They're struggling. Mission agencies are certainly struggling. And let me just mention a couple things we need to start doing. First, we need to, we meaning the church, all of us collectively, need to start recognizing that business is a calling, that business people are in full-time ministry. I wanted to pause for a second. I don't know how many of you read these and or read yesterday's. There was a story in here. It says, accountant finds her calling. I thought, oh, great, they have opened for business in here. Here it's a story about, a very complimentary story about this girl, best student in her class, just great job offers, just, you know, and she turns her back on all of that and decides to join the InterVarsity staff. And that's now she's developing leadership skills. Good. She would have never done that as an accountant. No. The person who helped her through this process, having faced a similar decision between a successful career in engineering and that of the ministry, he was able to help coach her through this difficult decision of turning her back on the accounting career and going into the ministry. See, and it's now I want to ease up. This was a student, a college student, who wrote this. Okay, so, but still, it's endemic. It is so deeply ingrained in the church. This is not an exceptional view here. This is the view of most churches, most professional clergy, and we need to recognize that being an accountant is a calling, and she is or would have been in full-time ministry. As an accountant. That's first place we have to start. And then churches, then rather than, some of you I've shared this before with, my wife is an MRI technologist, and she manages an MRI center. They do all of it, nuclear medicine, x-ray, CAT scans, you name it. And she manages this center, and she's very skilled, and she brings a degree of peace to this. Every job she's had, she's brought a degree of peace and shalom, I suppose you could say, at her workplace. And I believe God just gets a kick out of that. He loves to see her at work doing what she does best. And sometimes she does share Christ, occasionally. But that's not the things that, that's not when he cheers. I believe he's cheering all the time. He loves what she does. She also volunteers for our church. She runs the not the whole children's ministry, but she leads the missions part of the children's ministry. It takes about 2 or 3 hours a week. Our church gives her more praise, more accolades for those 2 or 3 hours a week. In fact, many probably don't even know she works during the week. So she gets honored, you know, praised, dinners on her behalf, you know, thanking her for her good work and her ministry and so forth. But the church has never equipped her, been able to equip. And this is something, it's not just our church. And I have tried, I have tried mightily, believe me. But they don't know. I mean, frankly, most churches, now many are doing it well, but equipping people for ministry in that 40-hour-a-week job. That's we need to start rethinking. Rather than helping them become ushers and teaching them to sing in the choir and so forth, teach them to be effective in the workplace and so forth. And then perhaps, and this is a process, start encouraging them to maybe develop relationships with international students and this sort of thing. I don't know how many of you know the name Patrick Lay. I had the privilege of being on his dissertation committee a few years ago, and he replicated Don Hamilton's research. Don Hamilton did a book in the early 80s called Tent Makers Speak, and he wanted to see what makes tent makers effective. You know, what are the characteristics and so on? And there's many things in common. They've led Bible study. They've had this ministry culture from early on, before they ever even thought about being tent makers. They've been witnessing and leading Bible studies. They recognize their work as a calling and these sorts of things. Well, Patrick, 20 years later, wanted to do it again and see, is this still true? What, you know, he confirmed many of the same things are true, but he found something different, very exceptional, and it was significantly more important than any of the rest. And it was involvement in international student ministry for at least a year was a marker, an important, in fact, the most important marker on who will ultimately be successful in a international context. Or at least a year's worth of experience ministering to international students in your local community. And so, but there's other ways too. But start encouraging them perhaps to go on short-term mission trips, these sorts of things. You know how that works. That, you know, suddenly our blinders come off, and many of us, that's what does it for us. And then we, and then equip them for cross-cultural ministry. Okay, again, this is a process, and it could be 5 or 10 years. The Moravians, there's one story in there. Those that went into British Columbia, the first time they tried, they made a foolish mistake, and everyone ended up dead. They were all killed. So, you know, that sets you back a bit, you know. They prepared. They didn't understand the culture and the language well enough, and there was a misunderstanding, and they got killed. They spent 30 years preparing for the next attempt. We Americans don't think that way. We just don't have that long of a time horizon. If it's not happening by next year, we want an explanation. Why hasn't it happened? But my research, again, are the Dwight Nordstroms and those sorts of people that are in a cross-cultural context started first in their own culture. And it's a process of 5 to 10 years after school. There are exceptions, but that's the majority. Okay, short-term and part-time opportunities. So you're not ready to go to Tajikistan, but you're interested in this, and you'd like to dabble in it maybe a little or check it out in a safer way. One opportunity, especially for the students, would be an internship. You might consider an internship with some of the people you're meeting here, and so on. Training and consulting. There are a number of organizations. I'll highlight two, I think two of the best ones here, that are doing this kind of work. There's one called Highmark, highmarkinc.org, that organizes short-term trips. So maybe you are a finance specialist or something, you work for an investment bank and this sort of thing, and you want to do a short-term trip, and they will help you, or maybe they already have a trip planned to one of these countries, and you'll spend 1 week or two, it depends, they're all different, doing a finance seminar, teaching local business people a bit about finance or marketing or whatnot. And there's actually more countries than this. And they work closely with existing missionaries and so on. In fact, all of these organizations I'll mention work closely with people on the ground. So the missionary in India or Poland, they know people who would be interested in the seminar, and so they actually help put it together. They do a lot of the legwork there in country, advertising and so forth, and bring this together. And then, so the American short-term team goes out for a week, sometimes two, to do the conferences. An organization called International Micro Enterprise Development, they have a slightly different model. It's a three-stage process where at the end of the three stages, there will be a handful of entrepreneurs who receive funding for a business. It's part of a strategy to build up the local church, to make them less dependent on American or Western missionaries in Western dollars. How do you do that? Well, you help them start their own businesses so they can support their own church and so on. And what they do, again, with the help of local missionaries in that area, is bring together maybe a group of 50 initially, 50 aspiring entrepreneurs. And IMED will bring a group of people from the States over to the country, and they'll hold a seminar for a few days, talk about, you know, what God thinks about business. You know, a lot of people, especially in other countries, they have the same dichotomy. They think business is evil and so on. And so you have to help them understand that God cares about business, that He loves business people and so on. And so they have to sort through that with a large group. And second stage, which is a few months later, another group, and often different people with different skill sets go out. And they help them flesh out an idea for a business, and they start putting together a business plan, these sorts of things. But by then, the group has shrunk to maybe 20 or so. And then finally, those that look most promising and so on, there's another round, three months or so later, where the people who evaluate the business plans then and decide which businesses should we loan money to and so forth. And by then, the group has gone way down. But very interesting model there. As far as I know, I think most of the churches that have been plugged into this are in the southeast, Atlanta and so on, but there may be others as well. But all right, another thing you might consider, I love this model. It's called a business development group. What is a business development group? This is a church-based strategy that connects business people in your church with business people in the developing world, Christian business people in the developing world. And it does that through a revolving loan fund. So let me give you a minute for those that are copying this. A church-based strategy to connect Christian business people with Christian entrepreneurs in the developing world to help them develop sustainable businesses that serve the purposes of God. And again, with a local administrator, I'm taking a group of students to El Salvador in January. The local administrator there is World Vision. Now, it's not usually World Vision, but they actually have a big presence there, and they have a lot of micro-enterprise development work happening there. So this is SME development, larger businesses, but it's still similar enough that they have been willing to help. So they're the ones who identify the Christians, the Christian businesses who would benefit from additional capital. Okay, these aren't startup businesses. These are Christian businessmen and women who already have a business who would benefit from a small loan, and it would help them grow. And they're real selective. They try to find people who are already active in their church and so on, so they're not looking for those who would promise to be active. If they had a loan, yes, I would become active in my church. They look for those who are already pouring themselves out for the sake of the gospel in the local community. And so with the help of them, there's the revolving loan fund, and then there's a long-term relationship here. So unlike the IMED or the other one, Highmark, this is a long-term relationship. You need to commit or be willing to commit to going down there twice a year at least, sending a group of people to see how they're doing. You have to let them know, you still care about them, their church, the ministries they're involved in, and so on. And you also care about that loan. Many of these entrepreneurs, they don't have access to capital. They're marginalized. They need to develop a good credit history. And so it's in their interest to pay back this loan. And, of course, it's in your interest, too, because you want to reloan it eventually later. You do want that loan back. So you have to let them know that you still care and, and so on. And it's a great way to connect the church, people in the West, with Christians in other countries. And you start praying for those people, those countries, in a new way. Business people now aren't being handed a hammer or something, or aren't being asked to do a VBS or something. Now they have a way to employ their skills on a short-term missions trip and so forth. And now it's never been done at a university before. This is an experiment. We've raised $5,000, and we're going down. We'll make one or two loans. We'll find out when we get there. We'll be visiting the businesses and selecting who gets the loans. But a little bit trickier in the case of a university, because students come and go, and so the continuity, how do we solve this? I believe alumni is going to be an important part of the solution, where they continue this relationship with us and with the local entrepreneurs. But anyway, with a church, it's easier. You guys know each other for years and years, and you might have a rotating basis. Some of you go one time, and then the next time the other group goes. Yeah.
I get your perspective on loans versus equity positions. And expecting some return.
Yeah. I really, he asked my perspective on loans versus taking an equity position in these businesses, we might have to talk about that afterwards. That's just too long for the time we have. I'd rather. In many countries, though, it's not easy to get your equity stake back out anyway. Loans just work better in those contexts. They don't have well-functioning stock markets, so you can't take it public. Maybe you can sell the business eventually to the employees and get your money back out that way. But it's much more complicated in developing countries. I don't want to unpack that here. Here's an example of a Christian man, had a bakery. He borrowed $3,000. It enabled him $1,500 for the new oven, and then $1,500 for the shelves and for working capital and this sort of thing. $3,000 goes a long way, as you probably know, in many of these countries, and it can really help businesses grow. Now, some are local. Their markets are local, like his, a bakery. Some are trying to tap into the global economy and so on. And here again, as an educator, I see a lot of potential here for student participation, marketing research, or help with their keeping their books straight and audits and all that sort of thing. There's many ways that students can be involved, but your folks in your own church too. So two organizations that are doing this. This one's in Slovakia, so you might want to start with Business Professional Network. A very good friend of mine, John Wharton, heads that up, and that's what Business Professional Network does. They help churches create these groups, and they help connect you with the appropriate people in the other country. But maybe you have your own people in that country. I've been trying to get my own church to do this. We have a missionary in Ethiopia that I've been trying to get us to start a business development group for Ethiopia, and just, again, having so much resistance at my church. Finally, for you students, you might consider a new initiative this summer, and hopefully on a regular basis thereafter, something called a boot camp, Marketplace Ministry Boot Camp, where you spend 7 weeks on residence, being mentored and going deep into this whole area of integrating your faith with your work and so on. There'll be, in connection with working, there'll be internships and so forth. And then mentoring after the boot camp, you'll be connected with a mentor and so forth, and a lot of other creative short-term or part-time opportunities that are worth looking into. So it starts. It's a process. You might start first with a business development group, and after a few years of going to El Salvador yourself or Croatia or something like that, you just say, I can't stand it any longer. I have to go. I have to move my family. We've prayed about it, and we're moving to Croatia ourselves. And so, but it's a process, and this might help that process. So, okay, good. We still have about 8 minutes. Yes, sir.
One metric of success, the lowest one that I'm willing to accept is that I've pointed out that this is the mountain, the kingdom we want to capture, and people know where I found my goods. How can I ensure that that happens? That's not the metric I'm shooting for, by the way. How can I ensure that people know that this is something that we do want to do? Not me, maybe somebody else.
Well, like the speaker yesterday too, he said it's a goal. Even if we achieve half of it, it's better to achieve 50% of an ambitious goal than 100% of a non-ambitious. So, yeah, you set the goal. Now, Crystal Almond, she might have thought she wasn't having quite the impact she was expecting, but she still had a huge one in retrospect.
Why did she not sell that? Why did she just close it out?
Yeah, I don't know. She actually turned it over to the employees, and actually now she's immersed in a lot of legal problems down there now, and I don't know. I haven't been wanting to pry. Plus, she's been in Colombia still trying to sort out all the... So, I don't know.
With the traditional scenario, going with the fundraising and donors, there's an intrinsic accountability that missionaries are tied to a local church as well as their donor base. What's it say that people who are engaged in these business enterprises aren't going out as Lone Rangers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those she said there's accountability built in when you're raising donor support and so on. Now you have relationships with several churches as well as an agency. And these independent-minded businesses that are going out on their own, are they Lone Rangers then, and so forth? And I would say, to a degree, yes. I mean, there's many variations of this. Some who are working very closely. For example, if I can put Joseph on the spot, there's some people from a large church who are helping him. He has a vision for a church in his demographic group there in the community. There's no church, there's no missionary activity in that demographic group. And he's had a burden to have a church planted there. And there's a church that's helping him, mentoring him through that process and so on. But there's others who, you know, business people are very independent-minded folks. And to get them to submit to the authority of a church is frankly harder. But I still get excited because you see what they're doing, and it's all very uncoordinated. I mean, I was telling the stories to someone today, a business in Juarez, that a businessman, Mexican, who had a burden for his city. Eventually the mayor said, well, if you care so much, then here, have the jail. You're in charge of the jail, which was a very corrupt place. And he, with a few other local businessmen, transformed that jail. And now the prisoners are working, some of them are working for his company rather than working in other ways, selling drugs and so on and so forth. He's not consulting an agency or being held accountable by anybody necessarily. But I get goosebumps when I hear these stories over and over again. And I know God's working, and he's using the Lone Rangers just as much as he's using the others. But you're right, Lone Rangers... There's no guarantee that he'll stay committed to that prison. You know, he may drift off, and you're right, that there's always that potential. Yes?
So would you let us know what in your opinion, are two or three of the outcomes, the priority outcomes that a business should achieve?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it should result in, say, the purpose of the business is not to set up evangelism, is it? I mean, if you were to say what would be the top three priorities that a business mission should achieve, what are the three things that you should achieve?
Well, I mean, I'll refer to our book. We were pretty specific and insisted that there was some evangelistic component to it, that in some way the church was either growing, or if there was no church, there was one being in the process of being planted in the process. So that's our orientation. That's not everybody. A lot of Christian businessmen aren't church planters. They're, you know, they care about the jail, but they're not thinking necessarily about can we get a church. So certainly financial viability would be an important one. I don't think we need to say much about that. Non-negotiables, I guess that's what you're asking for.
Financials is a question of survival.
Right.
But survival is not the final end.
Right.
Itself.
Right.
And you can survive doing other things. But what is it specifically that business and mission should achieve?
Yeah.
The good of the community, probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The building of the church and
okay.
the strengthening of the church.
Okay.
Know, what in your opinion?
Yeah. Okay. I can speak in somewhat broad terms like that, yeah, the building up of the church and contributing to the community. Let me refer back to, what did I call it, Manpower Services International. He's got 150 or some employees there and this sort of thing. And Christian manager, actually, the reason I visited, they had a dedication service for their new building and so on. Gospel was preached very clearly. It was a real exciting time for the business. But some of the work that they get is very tedious, and their educated people are bored with it. Well, there's, as you know, there's many handicapped people who are worse than marginalized. They're just non-entities in India. Well, there's a Christian ministry that is helping them develop job skills. And Manpower has started outsourcing some of that work to this other group. They love it. They're very good at it. They're very patient, and it gives them dignity. They are so tickled to death to have real work to do that's important work, just tedious, but important. And so that's one of several ways he has learned to use his business itself as to impact the community and the church also. There's, you know, evangelism and all that sort of thing happening with that group. But every case is so unique, and it's part of the creativity of these people. They're entrepreneurs, they're restless, they're always coming up with new ideas, and the things they're doing are just, you can't say it has to look like this necessarily, but I would say in general terms you're right. Some measurable impact on the community that, and ideally beyond just personal evangelism and this sort of thing, something that you can say it's because of the company itself. That's what differentiates tent making from business as mission, because it's the company using its supply chain or somehow leveraging its own operations for the kingdom. So like that business in Juarez now, he has employees now doing assembly work, and he was, you know, able to make that happen and so on. So it's more than just evangelization. I am an evangelical, and I would like to see evangelization happening and churches planted, but I would like to actually see more than that too, some broader impact too on the community. Yes, sir. Governments are pretty pragmatic. China is probably the most pragmatic of all. They'll kick people out who have no obvious benefit. If they're evangelizing, that's all we needed to know. You're out of here now. But other people like Dwight Nordstrom, who's very outspoken and high profile, doesn't care if we use a pseudonym or not, but he creates thousands of jobs and brings in millions of dollars of investment into their country. And so they tolerate him. And to a degree, most countries are like that. Maybe not quite as tolerant, but there's a lot of Christians who are very open about their faith. And it varies from country to country. I mean, proselytization is illegal in some cases, so you need to be a little careful. And ideally, what you want is to get them to ask the questions about your faith. You don't volunteer it, but you set up situations where they're asking you then about your faith. Oh, yeah. 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 And, there's still so many missionary in disguises out there. I mean, there's people, I've run into people who have a business card, and that's the extent of their business. Or an office with a filing cabinet and a desk, and they're drinking chai with the person who has an office next door. But there's no business here. There's, not even papers strewn around the desk or anything. It's so obvious that they're not doing anything, and which raises the natural question, why are you here then? So regretfully, there's still a lot of people who, in fact, it's promoted. Business, what's one of the advantages of starting a business? You can control how much time you put in work. You can, you don't have to work as hard. And so many people are choosing business because they think that'll help them to have more time witnessing. And it's just so counterproductive. And the ones I believe that are having the biggest impact are the ones that are the real business people, and many times independent, aren't connected with any agency whatsoever. And they're having far more impact. I'm almost willing to say that. I mean, just that there's much more happening outside of the traditional mission circles than inside at the moment, at least in a business context.
My question maybe is really timely, given your comments. I'm real excited about business and mission, but I feel a little uncomfortable with the hard distinction between traditional missions and business and mission. So I'll just throw two examples out. I know the UN, I believe, says that in microeconomic development, 90% of organizations are not sustainable. So they rely on donations, they rely on contributions. And, John Sage of Pura Vida, who I'm sure you know much better than me, I mean, he got his start because he could employ himself for free and he had his own capital to give. So that was the partnership of traditional contribution and business skills. So would you accept that it might be better to talk about how traditional missions and businesses' missions can be complementary and work together and maybe seek sustainability, but not quite such a strong distinction?
I'm not dogmatic about that. I mean, in even the secular world, they're blending. There's businesses that were started with the help of donor funds and this sort of thing. And the term social enterprise and social entrepreneurship is now out there to describe that, which is basically BAM, only in a secular context. But it gets tricky, though, I mean, because of IRS laws. If you have charitable donations that are going into a business, now who owns that business and who's benefiting from the business? So it does get complicated, but you're right. I mean, there are some of those. Now, John Sage didn't run into that problem. It's his own company, and he...
Yeah, but he did rely on a contribution to get going, his own ability to employ himself. So, although he is seeking sustainability, many of these businesses' missions start as a donor-funded or free labor organization. I mean,
You could say that about businesses in general. Okay. Microsoft. I mean, Bill Gates supported himself while he was building this cockamamie idea of a computer for every desktop, in the 70s. Yeah. How do startups get good employees. They don't pay them high salaries. They pay them options, a promise of salary in the future.
But John Sage isn't in it for the options.
Right, right.
He's got his options already. That's why he's doing it.
Yeah. But I would disagree. You say many BAM businesses are started with donations, and I would disagree.
Okay,
I mean, at least within missions, if you're talking about the missions community, yes. But if you're talking about the guy who started the Juarez, you know, he's or Joseph or Dwight, I mean, they started with their own sweat equity, which you could say is a donation, but they. But yeah, yeah. Yes.
What do you see as the difference between BAM and social engineering or entrepreneurship if you don't have
The difference between BAM and social entrepreneurship if you don't have what?
Some type of outreach, direct planning.
The distinction is hard to make at that point. You're right. But one thing I'd like to mention, though, is for those of you who are with ministries or churches and you're thinking about starting businesses and so forth, there's already a lot of literature out there. If you buy these books, the social entrepreneurship books, there's thick books on how to stay out of legal trouble with the IRS and all these sorts of things. So it's a good place to start to learn how to do it properly and so on. And our distinction is that we have this evangelical focus, and the kingdom of God and everything else that goes with that. Yes?
Yeah, you talked about a couple of the successes in a play. One succeeded and then it may have failed. And starting a business is inherently risky. If you look at venture capitally funded businesses, 50% of those fail outright.
Yeah.
Are there any statistics or any data that suggest what the success rate of this group?
No. I'm glad. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Which raises another great philosophical question, though. That one enterprise that the Moravians were involved in took them 30 years to prepare the second time. But it was a mission that lasted 150 years then as a result. But then it failed. But other times, there's businesses that fail after 5 years. Now, do we avoid business as mission because business is inherently risky? And what if you do have a successful BAM business, but then sell it after 10 years? Or are we not allowed to sell it because it's a kingdom business, so we can't sell? So what makes it successful?
And what keeps it successful?
Yeah.
Because it's not a static world. And that business has to evolve.
Yeah. So we're over time, so I think if you need to go, you can. I'll stay here for more. Yes, sir.